For me personally, and I think that I'm the same as probably as my ladies that I replicate their journeys, I think that the important thing is having a purpose to your travel. And for example, I talked about Isabella Bird and having her book and finding all those landmarks that she talked about. Nobody's ever done that. Finding this mud house that she described, sitting out on the balcony and in the winter sun and the painted walls and everything. I think it's just so lovely to have a purpose to travel. And so, as I said, it's never going to be the destination for me. It's always going to be the traveling. That's the exciting part.
That's Jackie Hill Murphy on episode 52 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. I hope that you're all well. If you're new to the All Things Risk podcast, around here we go deep and long form using the lenses of risk and uncertainty to learn about the world in which we live, to learn about risk taking, and just to perhaps open up our minds a little bit. We have a wonderful conversation for you today. It's about exploration, adventure, travel into the unknown, and a lot more. To kick this off, just wanted to ask a question, and that was, did you know that in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries, there were some extraordinary women adventurers? I'm guessing that you probably didn't know that, or perhaps you learned about that very recently. And my guest has been out to change all of that. I want you to meet Jackie Hill Murphy. Jackie is an explorer, a teacher, a filmmaker, and an author. And she recently wrote a book entitled Adventuresses, Rediscovering Daring Voyages into the Unknown. And it's a book of stories of three early female explorers who traveled to remote regions of the world. Women like Isabella Godin, who was the first known woman to travel the length of the Amazon in 1769, or Mary Kingsley, who climbed Mount Cameroon in 1885, Isabella Bird, who journeyed over the Dagar Pass in 1890. And not only did Jackie write about these women, she recreated their voyages. And Jackie also recreated the fascinating voyage of another Victorian female explorer, Kate Marson, who journeyed by horse and sledge across Siberia. And Jackie's forthcoming book is about this extraordinary woman. There is so much interesting stuff here, like the role of women in these societies during those eras, the motivations that these women had for their journeys, and so on. And Jackie is an excellent storyteller, and she is the perfect person to tell the stories of these women. And we cover Jackie's background, including a 1988 year-long Pan-African trip that she took. We get into her inspiration to recreate these journeys and to write these books. We get some very interesting stories from Jackie during her voyages to retrace the steps of her adventuresses. We talk about travel into the unknown. We get into the fascinating Kate Marston, who is, as I mentioned, the subject of Jackie's forthcoming book, and tons more. Jackie is based in Bristol here in the United Kingdom, and we sat down when Jackie was recently in London, where I am based. It was a lot of fun for me to speak to her, and I'm sure that's going to come through in the conversation, and I am sure that you will enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Jackie Hill Murphy. Welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's very, very nice to be here, Ben.
Before we get into adventuresses and exotic parts of the world, I was wondering if you could just, for my listeners, give a little bit of a background to yourself, who you are, that type, what you do, that type of thing.
Oh, well, I'm an ex-teacher mm-hmm. who was never a very happy teacher. And I guess I lived my teaching career thinking about my escape, which happened eventually when I went in a dugout canoe down the Amazon River. So I have always had a thirst for travel and adventure. I've never really enjoyed just traveling to a destination. It's always the getting there for me. Mm-hmm. And this has become more and more adventurous and maybe a bit more dangerous. And now I write books about it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, it's a very interesting place I'm in because now I inspire other people about traveling. So that's very nice.
Very cool. Quite well. Could we? Where does that come from?
Okay, I get asked that question a lot. When I was young, like less than 10, I read a lot of books mm-hmm. about travel, and I particularly loved all the Gerald Dull animal collecting books. I just read everything I could, but I remember reading I remember reading Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki expedition when I was quite young, probably about 9. And it absolutely swept me away. And I think that that's where the spirit of wanderlust entered my soul. I really do. And then after that, I continue to read that sort of book. Mm-hmm. And John Blashford Snell particularly inspired me when I was in my 20s. And especially his journeys across the Darien Gap, which is an area which, you know, is not possible to get across, and he got across. Mm-hmm. And it's just so all my teaching career and being a mother and bringing up a son, it was always there, and I always wanted to get out there and do something eventually, which I did.
I think that type of story resonates with a lot of people. We're having an interesting conversation about it before, or about the world in which we live, just before we started. And I think there are a lot of us who want to go out and do something and travel and have that sense of wanderlust, but it might be repressed, but it's somehow for you manage to unbottle it.
Not without a lot of procrastination. Mm. And you know, sometimes it's the hardest thing is actually saying you're going to go. Mm. You can talk about it forever, but the actual saying I'm going to go is different. And recently I talked about my trip down the Amazon River, one end to the other, which I did in December, and somebody asked me, so when did you decide to go? What was the point? And I said, well, I actually announced it on Facebook because then I knew I couldn't go back on it. I had to go on it. Right. I had to, you know, I don't want to bore people. Say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But you have to say, right, okay, fine. And it's like my trip to Siberia. I just booked a plane ticket and said, right, mm-hmm. I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to cross Siberia. So I think that is quite a big hurdle. And they do say, don't they, that the travel of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. And I think that is the first step, really. Mm-hmm. It's booking a ticket or getting out there or just organizing it.
Can we talk a little bit about... So I read in your bio that in 1988 you crossed Africa.
That's right.
Was that the kind of the main expedition that
I think
opened it up for you?
I think so, because my life was always before and after that expedition, because mm-hmm. it was so life-changing. Because if you think about 1988, it was before the Algerian mm-hmm. Civil War, so there was free passage, a lot of people and a lot of nationalities doing that sort of expedition, and it was interesting for me to see who they were. You know, it was mm-hmm. a lot of Germans, a lot of French crossing mm-hmm. the Sahara Desert. But you've got to think about this is... prior to mobile phones, mm-hmm. to satellite phones, to email mm-hmm. in 1988. So that was probably more like going into the unknown than anything else, because unless you can find a way of calling somebody back home and telling them you're safe, they don't know, like Rihanna. So does that make travel more interesting or less interesting? The mm-hmm. fact that, you know, when I was going down the Amazon River, we could, with the help of this little wireless mm-hmm. Gadget that we had, we could harness cell phones along the way and pick up email, you know, when we were, you know, the nearest people were hostile tribes. So does that make it a little less fascinating? Does it take the edge off it when you know that you can instantly be in touch with the outside world? I don't know, but the 1988 trip certainly was pretty amazing. And then I did visit villages. I can remember around Timbuktu, and we're talking about Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, that area, going west to Senegal, which we did, where there were children who hadn't seen a white person. And I found that most extraordinary. And, you know, that's... I always feel now that my expeditions are exploring cultures and that and bringing back something that's new from those cultures. And that was for me, to come back and say, there are people out there who haven't seen a white person. They're frightened of me, you know. They're calling Toubabou, which is, you know, white nigger at the Land Rover, is extraordinary, because then that puts the boot on the other foot, doesn't it, when we experience people in our culture, you know. So that was an eye-opener. But it did have its very dangerous moments, that expedition.
Right. Where were you in your... Did you do something in the lead-up to that? Did you where did you kind of get the, I don't know, the strength or the resolve to say, I'm doing this?
Just reading those books.
Okay.
The John Blashford Snell, you know, and all those sorts of ones. And went in a Land Rover, was with my ex-husband. And it was both something we both wanted to do so much. And at the time, it was also getting off the treadmill quite young.
And how old were you at the time?
I was in my 30s, early 30s, And so that was very much getting off a treadmill. And my ex-husband was a lawyer. And it was really discovering ourselves, I think, and who we were and you know, going out there and visiting people and way beyond places.
Right. It started... Where did it start and where did it end?
Left in England and come back to England.
Of course.
So it was... across Europe. Traveled to Morocco. Morocco traveled... crossed into Algeria.
Right.
All the way down through the Sahara Desert. When we got to Niger, turned west towards Senegal, down through all the... Senegal. You hadn't asked me that now. I can't remember the name. Guinea-Bissau.
There we go.
And then missed out Liberia because there was a war going on. And then came back down through the Gold Coast, through Nigeria. Now, that was very interesting because we travelled through the area which is now Boko Haram land.
Right.
And actually, I've been asked to go and speak on Nigerian television because they're very interested that I drove to Lagos through all that area and then into Cameroon and then back through the Sahara Desert again.
Wow. What was that area like that is now the Boko Haram?
It was just beautiful scrubland. It was just forest, lovely people coming out and waving to us. You know, people would stand up from working in the field with their handmade tools. They would stand up, they would wave to us, and then they would lean back down and carry on. And we tried to take gifts, but you know, it's perhaps they don't want that, you know. We tried to interact with them as much as we could.
Wow. So I guess after something like that, there's no going back to the treadmill, is there?
Well, there is eventually, because you say you are never going to take for granted running water again. You're never ever going to take for granted going in a supermarket and seeing all these fabulous fruit and vegetables, but unfortunately, you know, that you have to keep reminding yourself, because it does wear off, but it's good for a while.
So I mean, that in and of itself, though, is an expedition that most people in the world won't be able to do or won't do.
I don't think they'd want to do it, because there was such an element of the unknown. Plus it's you've got to be willing to fund it through perhaps selling a house or doing something very drastic.
Is that more or less what you did?
We did. And so some people would say, having a house is too important. But, you know, I suppose in the 80s we weren't really quite so concerned about that. And then again, it's people just would not want to take that time off their career.
How long did it take?
We've gone for a year.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, but I guess what I was getting at is you didn't go back to being a teacher.
You did.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Because I had to make a living. That was what I was trained in. And so I went back and I had years of being an English and drama teacher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Always, you know, the memories of that trip always stayed with me.
Yes. Okay. Could we perhaps fast forward to your latest project, and maybe we can tie some things back along the way? But these recreating these journeys of women explorers, that led into your book, Adventuresses,
and the second book, which is about to come out.
Right.
Okay. Well.
What inspired you to do this?
The starting point was doing a master's degree and having found the story of Isabella Godin in the Royal Geographical Society Old Library, and found the story of Isabella Godin travelled the Amazon River in 1769, and all of her party died and she almost perished. Mm. It is the most remarkable story. And so I used that material for my master's degree in the early 90s, and I did a collection of writing around it, and I always promised myself that one day I would go back and I would recreate the first 500 miles of her journey, of which I did, and that was when I gave up teaching. I gave up teaching and said I'm going to go and recreate this journey. So that was up into the Peruvian border, recreated her journey, and then I've just recently, last year, come back from doing the whole of her journey. And the reason that that journey was so dangerous was because I wanted to take her route, which I was told it's not possible to get down. By the Peruvian embassy, did not recommend that I went because it was a particularly hostile area. But to me, the romance of it was going on that route. So I did everything I could to make sure I was safe and my party was safe. But going back to what you were saying, so when I got back the first time from doing that journey, everybody was fascinated. They said, oh, that's really, really interesting. You know, tell me about it. I end up telling the story of Isabella Godin so many times and about how she was lost in the jungle. And then people wanted to see it. I started, you know, going out to speaking engagements, showing people this area where she'd lost and the Kichwa Indians who'd taken me down and who got friendly with and stayed in their village. And I thought, this is so interesting. Let's do another one. And so the next one after that was Mary Kingsley, who climbed Mount Cameroon. And that's when I moved in to my Victorian ladies, because the Victorian women who became the first explorers were all around the 1890s. And I really wanted to know what it was about that era that created these women. And Mary Kingsley, particularly, she was a spinster. She nursed her parents until they died. She had no experiences of life. She was uneducated. She didn't really have any experience with men. And yet, when she was traveling on a ship down to Gabon, where she had decided that she wanted to go and study fetish and cannibal tribes, which was, you know, you've got to think that that's quite a thing for a spinster. In her very traditional clothes, because she would never make allowances for the weather or you know, the hot weather or anything. So there she would have been in her long dress and her hat and her umbrella. On the way back from doing that trip, she saw Mount Cameroon and she said, I want to climb that mountain. And the captain of the ship, who I don't think wanted her to get off, I think he quite liked having her company on board, said, oh, no, ma'am, that's no picnic. And it's the fact that he said to her, that's no picnic, that made her want to do it even more. And so she saw it on the way down, and when she came back, she said, I'm getting off and I'm going to climb that mountain. And she never saw the top of, and I never saw the top of it. It's constantly shrouded in mist. Now, you think about it. I had, by email, I had lined up a hotel and I had lined up guide and porters and somebody to come and drive us up to the starting point, which was the beginning of football. She didn't have any of that. So she just had rather, I wouldn't say corrupt, but dodgy German governors who, again, liked her company, but they were dodgy because they were very colonial, because it was German, that land, and they treated people very badly. And she was not impressed by seeing how they treated, particularly black people. Mm. And she became the mouthpiece for local people and for, you know, this was, you've got to think about what people's attitude was, their colonial attitude mm-hmm. towards African people in that time was dreadful. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the first people who went back and said, no, come on, you've got to stop that. They're as intelligent as we are. Mm. So she's very unapplauded, this lady, for her mm. work. Anyway, so she got rid of these horrible sort of like racist governors who tried to organize her. She found her own guides and porters who didn't know what it's like to be a porter, so they dropped out halfway up.
Right.
So, you know, she would give them a blanket and some money, and she said, you're going to help me climb that mountain. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't believe that a white woman wanted to do that. I mean, it was like mm-hmm. the something that was unheard of for a woman mm-hmm. to climb. And it was Mongo Ma Lobe. It was the throne of thunder. I mean, it's like, even their locals didn't go up it for a woman to go up. It was mm-hmm. most extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And so they sold their blankets and they drank all their rum and their water and spent the money. And so she said, well, come on, we're going. She said, well, you know, I'm cold, I haven't got a blanket. Because they seriously didn't believe that she... And they seriously didn't believe a woman could mm-hmm. lead them. So the last bit she ended up doing by herself. But her guides had wonderful names like Bum and Headman and Cook and... Kefala and things like that, and I think one of the loveliest quotes from her book, because of course she wrote beautiful books mm-hmm. in beautiful prose about what she saw, and one of the most beautiful quotes is saying on the way down, she'd gone to the top by herself, remember, and she was on the way back down, this is 4,095 meters, one of her guides who was meant to have gone up with her, or porters, whether wandering around, and she said that she came across a madman in a mist on a mountain, and you know, to write in this beautiful sort of alliterative way when she was uneducated is fantastic. But her description is fabulous. And so I could follow her description, her passages all the way along. And I know that she did go to that mountain, but mm-hmm. we had a guide. There's no way he wouldn't let us out of the hut mm. for 3 days because of the rain. He said it's too dangerous. Mm. There was no hut for her.
No.
So we were stuck in a rat-infested hut that was the nastiest little place you can imagine for 3 days. And you're to wear profound darkness because there's no light pollution when you're up a mountain. And for her to have done that alone.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely wow. So I love her to bits. And she did that in 1895.
What was her motivation, driver? What?
Well, one of her motivations was similar to Isabella Bird, that if she mm-hmm. was in England, she mm-hmm. had a life of domestic servitude. Mm. She was a spinster, but she'd been left a small amount of money. Mm. But she could never go and travel while her brother was in England because she had to then be his housekeeper. Oh, and right. she had to be. There was no two ways about it. Mm-hmm. You know, she was very Victorian, that if he's in England, she had to be his housekeeper. But the rest of the time, she was doing this incredible traveling mm-hmm. and writing about it. And her books are still published today, mm-hmm. Travels in West Africa. And as I say, when she came back, although she didn't want it to be known, she became a mouthpiece to the government and to the Church of England mm-hmm. on what it was, on the way that local people were being treated. Right. So she, you know, that was thin end of the wedge. Mm. She didn't want to become seen as a new woman. And that new woman was emerging in the 1890s. This was new woman dressing a little different way, you know, being a bit more daring. But she didn't allow herself to be seen that way because she didn't want the government to say, well, look at her, you know, she's...
Right.
I think it's equivalent of like, you know, a bit of a hippie, you know, a new age traveller.
Yeah, yeah.
So she stayed absolutely the Victorian woman so that they would listen. Isn't that interesting? So by now you've got the bicycle that's available mm-hmm. to women, which opened up their horizons so they could travel just a bit further away than normal without a chaperone. Because of the bicycle, the hem lengths were beginning to go up. Mm. Women were wearing bloomers. The hem lengths never went down again, and that's all the 1890s. Mm-hmm. So the new woman, like Constance Wilde, who was the lady about town dressing in the new aesthetic dress, mm-hmm. which would be the equivalent of being a hippie today, mm-hmm. you know, lovely loud colours, mm-hmm. you know, moving away from the traditional type of outfit. She was like being seen then in the new women's restaurants, of which one is in that beautiful building opposite Selfridges in Oxford Street. Mm-hmm. There's a lovely red brick building, and the house, the building on the shop on the far right corner is the first restaurant for women called Dorothy's, and they were being seen there and being talked. They were talking about feminism and liberalism, and no doubt travel as well. Mm-hmm. Mary Kingsley didn't fall into that, but Kate Marsden did, who crossed mm-hmm. Siberia mm-hmm. Kate Marsden crossed Siberia in 1891. And Isabella Bird. Now, Isabella Bird didn't come back for very long.
Right.
Because she felt ill in England. She only felt really well when she was travelling. When she went, she was gone for years at a time, which, again, is a different thing for us, because right. we get on a plane right. and we go, and we have a return ticket.
You couldn't do that at that time. You were going for months.
You went for... Mm. She went for 2 or 3 years mm-hmm. at a time, mm-hmm. yes. And again, she came back, and she would then write her books. But she was also very fearful of domestic servitude, because mm-hmm. apart from being married for a few years to Dr. Bishop, who mm-hmm. died, there were no other opportunities for women, you know, and especially if you mm-hmm. didn't have an older brother look after mm-hmm. you financially, or, you know, there was no welfare, mm-hmm. There really wasn't anything apart from a workhouse if you didn't have work. And women weren't allowed to have careers. Mm-hmm. You think they were in a really difficult position. So it's almost understandable why they then did go and travel if they had the chance, because right. they could escape those quite mundane expectations mm-hmm. of them. Mm-hmm. And so Isabella Bird, as I said, she felt trapped. Mm-hmm. Mary Kingsley sadly died very young, and she went to nurse in the Boer War. She was buried out at sea. Isabella Bird, who did most of her travel in China,
okay.
along
Can
the Yangtze River.
Talk about
River.
Her a little bit.
Yeah, let's
yes.
talk about. I replicated her journey in northern India in Ladakh mm-hmm. over the mountains. Mm-hmm. So this would be up to 4,500 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very high up. And she went on a yak, and I had to walk, because there are no rideable yaks.
Right.
So this is, you talk about climbing the Digar Pass up into wow. Nubra, right to the border of what is now Chinese-occupied
yes.
Tibet. And she'd come in through Srinagar, and I couldn't do that if I wanted to, because
okay.
the Foreign Office says it's not safe. So however brave I want to be, you know, and... For a start, I can't get a horse. No mm-hmm. one's going to lend me one. Mm-hmm. And if the Foreign Office says, we don't recommend you travel
yes.
there, it voids your travel insurance.
Mm-hmm.
So however brave you want mm-hmm. to be, you have to decide, are you going to be reckless?
Yes, yes. Well, it's a different dynamic,
there is
right?
a, yes. It's a different yes. dynamic, isn't it? And so she did that journey because she was with some missionaries mm-hmm. from the Monrovians Church, who said, join us, because we are going to go and visit this right up into northern Ladakh to visit people up there. She wasn't going to be a missionary, but what she did was she was visiting cultures. She was visiting cultures where they had never seen a European woman. They thought she was Queen Victoria, and she would be dressed up, you know, and she was quite stout. And mm-hmm. they, when she arrived on her horse or her yak, they thought she was Queen Victoria. So that's why I think that these women were explorers.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in a way that is why people call me an explorer, because men, well, you know, exploration in the Victorian times belonged to men.
Yeah.
And they really didn't applaud these women. And I think that's why these women's names disappeared into obscurity.
Mm.
But women were collecting stories about the cultures, about their ancient mm-hmm. ceremonies, whereas the men were off discovering the mouths of rivers and
yes,
climbing
yes.
mountains and things like that. You think about, you know, Speke and Grant and Stanley at the source of the Nile, and all of those happen in Africa. And sometimes I have been able to experience those ancient ceremonies myself. And so I'm coming back, and
you
I'm also reporting.
Tea, you had tea with the King of Ladakh.
Tea apparently. With the King of Ladakh. And how extraordinary is that? And I've still got my little handful of pistachio nuts. So I'm coming and I'm reporting back about it in the same way, about a culture that, you know, is very rarely visited. But that's certainly what Isabella Bird was doing. Her first travels were in the Rocky Mountains.
Mm.
From the very, very first travellers into the Rocky Mountains. And then mostly in China. But then she did this trip in through India. And then after Ladakh, she went directly south and ended up... traveling all the way through India and leaving by one of the western ports in India. So what I discovered about her was, I mean, I just stood right inside her shoes, and I almost felt that I was her alter ego for a while, because I was, you know, I found a house that she described in her book that painted on, that was sinking into the earth, that I have now reported to the archaeological department in India, and we positively identified that's her house. And then, wow, apart from the fact that I had to walk, there was no yak for me, then having tea with the king of Ladakh, you know, I just thought, you know, that's fantastic. So now I can write about her, and now I can really let everyone know who she was again now, which, you know, I hope so. So a great lady, and she lived to the age of 70. She was on her way on another journey. I mean, she never ever stopped traveling. She was just great.
Well, Isabella Bird and Mary Kingsley. I mean, one of the things that just popped up in my thoughts as you were describing, one is Isabella's study of the local cultures and things like this, and same, you know, Mary Kingsley's, I don't know if you would call it advocacy, but her views on how the local people were treated. I'm just wondering if their work was made a bit more prominent at the time. I know there are many factors that inhibited that, but would we have some different outcomes in terms of policies towards colonialism?
I think Mary Kingsley, we don't know, because she kept it very quiet, but she was definitely talking to them about the treatment of people and the treatment of black people in Africa, and, you know, who, you know, so they're not savages. These are highly intelligent people, and we need to start treating them better. And certainly the German governor was changed, but, you know, with their racist attitudes. It would be good to think that it was women that heralded that in a big way, wasn't it? I think that the way I feel about Mary Kingsley and Isabella Bird is they had no one to protect them. They were really on their own. And these were women who weren't really used to male company. And they had no one to protect them, and no one to bury them if anything happened to them. You think about it, apart from, you know, maybe missionaries that might have been in those places.
Did you get a sense from your work that any of these women were, or the level of fear that they had?
No. I think that that's what's most extraordinary in their books as well. I don't. In fact, Isabella Bird had to cross the River Shayok, and it was all the ice was melting, and it was so dangerous that they were. The Indians could have, like, you know, it didn't, their local guides didn't want to go with them. They said, we're all going to die. And they were all praying, we are all going to die. It was that dangerous. I have to point out that the glaciers have gone. You know, that's evidence of global warming. You know, the biggest changes for me was where there was a glacier, there wasn't anymore. You know, but it was those glaciers that were, it was the summer melt. It was going into the shark. So her horse drowned underneath her, and she broke ribs. And she, in her book, she said, I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want to upset them. So, you know, she hid it. So there's great stoicism, isn't it? But they had no one to protect them. They were just really, really tough. And I think relied on their common sense, really. But they didn't stop them.
Did you get a sense that they did a lot of as much preparation as they could? Or did they...
That's an interesting question. I found one book called, printed in 1889, called Hints to Lady Travellers. And it would have been absolutely no use to them whatsoever. It's all to do with travelling with your servants. How to put a deck chair up on a ship, on the deck of a ship. While not letting your skirt blow up in your face. What to do with your dirty linen on board a ship. Things like, drop it in the sea. It's just absolutely shocking. In fact, it talks about train travel, and it says, be careful when you're throwing your empty soda bottles out of the window that you don't hit anybody. know, things have changed,
right.
haven't they?
Yes.
No, that's the only book I've ever found.
Right.
And it's no advice whatsoever that would have been of use to them.
Yes.
And I'm not quite sure who they would have talked to, really.
Right. But you don't get a sense that these women were reckless.
No.
They must have
done they thought hard about it. They obviously talked to people who had been dying. I think Mary Kings would have talked to her father, who did travel quite a lot before he died. She had to nurse him to his death, as I said. But, you know, sometimes I feel like Mary Kingsley expected to die. I think she thought that, that was it when she climbed that mountain. She almost thought, you know, well, that's fine. You know, if I die, what else have I got to go back to, really? That was a bit sad. I think Isabella Bird had a bit more a zest for life in her. When she came back to her sister, Henrietta, who, when she died, it was pretty devastating for Isabella Bird. But Henrietta did the cooking and the cleaning so that Isabella could write her books. So, you know, there was a bit of domestic servitude there going on. But.
Okay. That is interesting. I wouldn't have thought that they just sort of, well, you know, that Mary Kingsley said, I'm going to climb that mountain on a whim.
Yeah.
But
she planned going to Gabon.
Mm-hmm.
But she never planned stopping off at Mount Cameroon.
Right, right.
And she says that she got wetter than the Atlantic, so no raincoat, nothing to carry water in. She would have had a demijohn to carry water in, ones we make beer in now. She had a camp bed made out of canvas that didn't have any holes in it, so all the water stayed in it because she had no tent or anything. It was really uncomfortable. You know, you have to think what drove her to want to carry on when she was as wet as the Atlantic.
Yes.
With this hopeless group of guides and porters who probably must have admired her greatly, I think, really, at the end of it, that she did it.
Absolutely, yes. Although she would have thoroughly appreciated Gore-Tex, I imagined.
Gore-Tex, you know, I think all the time about how I'd love to have given them a raincoat.
It sounds like it would have been rather miserable going up.
Definitely.
I do want to talk about Kate Marsden in a bit more detail, because it's the subject. She's the subject of your upcoming book, and she seems like a very interesting character.
Kate Marsden. Well, I personally think... Well, let me start again. it's taken me 2 years to write this biography, and it's been quite difficult because I had to unravel her personality quite a lot. She, again, had to try and make a living for herself in a time when women didn't really have careers. So the only option really was nursing. So she became a nurse and at the age of 17 and straight away asked to join a group of 8 other nurses who were going out to what is now Bulgaria to nurse in the Russian-Turkish War. Now, this is the end of the Ottoman Empire War. This is 1877, 1878. And what those 8 girls must have seen must have been horrendous, because we know that there were at least 50,000 deaths on the Turkish side alone. And she was nursing the Russians. So to keep it very brief, what those girls saw and did must have created some sort of stress, post-traumatic stress, certainly in Kate Marsden. And while she was there, she seemed to make a vow to devote her life to leprosy for some reason. Her 7 brothers and sisters all had died or would die during her lifetime of tuberculosis.
Right, right.
Consumption, which we know is a bacteria. And so is leprosy. So antibiotics cleared up most of those, you know, straight away. And that's why we don't have tuberculosis anymore. But that was not going to be discovered for another, you know, 30 years before it became possible for that to be. So she had this great drive to help lepers. So she went back to England and became a nurse in various places. And eventually went out to New Zealand and became in charge of Wellington Hospital there and their wards. Somewhere in the line, along the line, she upset people. Things happened in her life. Maybe it was a time when she had nervous breakdowns or something like that, especially with all her family dying. It was only her mother and her left in the end. But she had these... she upset people a lot, especially in New Zealand. So she came back to England. We're talking about the end of the 1880s. Beginning of the 1890s, was told that she was entitled to an award from the Russian royal family. So she went out to the Russian royal family to collect this award for her work in the Russian-Turkish War, 1878. Mm. And she told them that she wanted to devote her life to leprosy. And we don't know at what point, but she was told that there was a herb in Siberia that could cure leprosy. And also she found out that there were lepers who were cast out into the snow in the forest, and the word for devil was the same as lepers. And so the royal family, she got the royal family behind her to do this expedition across Russia. Went back to England, got the royal family here, Queen Victoria on her side, started collecting money to go and do this great journey to find evidence of the lepers and to find this herb. My book is a dual narrative of my story, my journey across of Siberia, and her journey across Siberia. Yep. Because I want to highlight how difficult it was for her. She had to do it over the course of a year, yep, by sledge and horseback at minus 50. Mine was mine was hard enough.
Yes.
Doing it by Trans-Siberian Express till it ran out, then Lake Baikal, then getting onto other railways, smaller railways, then getting onto bus journeys on unmade roads, because where my journey ended in Sakha province, there are no tarmac roads in the whole of Sakha province, which is like, you know, five times the size of France or something. That's huge. It's only unmade roads. And during that time I was doing that journey, I was thinking about what drove her to do that, to take that. You know, she had this outfit made by Jaeger, which was, it's a year old in 1891, that was made using the layer effect. And she had so many layers on against the cold that actually she couldn't move. So she had to be hoisted into the sledge. Sometimes she was very ill from being in the sledge for so long and being thrown around. You know, it was not comfortable. Finally, she got to Yakutsk, and I got to Yakutsk. And what I found, you know, the city, which is called the coldest city in the world, and I luckily was there in summer. And she arrived the end of winter, end of spring. So it was possible for her to get by ferry across the River Lena, which there's no way to get to Sakha province unless you get across on the ice or by a ferry. So in the breaking up season, it's just not possible to get. I mean, it's still a very, very hard place to get to. You know, all the way, people kept saying to me, why don't you fly? So then she did a 2,000-mile on horseback ride around to find evidence of lepers. Her evidence did lead to the opening of a leper colony. But during that time, 1890s, evidence of her wrongdoings, dodgy lifestyle, were beginning to build up and being printed in the press.
Right, right. Could we talk a little bit about it? Because she does have a colourful... was it fraud that she was accused of?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I found that the best way for me to deal with writing the book was to go back and talk to her. And actually it works. I do go back in time and I do sit down and talk to her, because I just had to try and...
How do you do that? What?
I flew back in time.
Okay.
That does sound very bizarre, but I used to meet her at various places, like Lion's Tea Room in London.
Okay.
And another reason for doing that was because I wanted my... Because, of course, this will be translated into Russian, because they're fascinated by her in Russian. Right. And it's lovely, this links that I'm forging with this little village in a forest, which is where this leper colony is. And I have to just sidetrack for a minute and tell you that at the end of my journey, there was 100 people in full national costume in the field waiting for me. It was the most humbling moment of my life. And I think, in a way, that should have been for her, but she was never allowed back because of the scandal. So 125 years later, there is these people singing and dancing with the traditional music. and all in costume. It was fantastic. And they have a little museum to her there, and they have a statue and the remains of her leper colony there. And all that's documented in my book. But my going back to meet her also is a good opportunity for the Russians to see what life was like in London in the 1890s. And I wanted Kate to see me as a modern girl, because sometimes I'm dressed up in Victorian outfit, and sometimes I'm just dressed as I am now with my knees showing and my hair showing, because I wanted her to see modern woman that she was really the forefront of, because she broke the mold. She had to fight against so many people who wanted to put her in her place. And so new woman in the 1890s, of which she was one, and you know, Constance Wilde was one, and in a way, well, Mary Kingsley wasn't, but they all became the suffragists that turned into suffragettes. So that's how it went. And then you had the first women's newspapers, the Penny Paper, the Women's Herald. They were definitely publishing their papers, talking about new woman and new clothes, new styles of dress, the bicycle, you know, interviewing strong women and people who were being independent, and they were beginning to have careers. So so that was what all that was about. So I wanted her to see me as a modern woman. So you might think that it sounds rather strange, but I have to say it works very well. And people have told me they really like it. So I come down firmly in her favour. So at the time, she was totally destroyed by scandal through the papers. She was like, you're not allowed to run your leper, your charity anymore, the St. Francis Leper Guild.
What was it that she was accused of doing?
She was accused of embezzling the funds, of lying and being a lesbian. And it was, in the end, Queen Victoria is the only person that stood by her and did not add to the criticism. She fought it and fought it and fought it all her life. She brought out a book called Vindication, but it was too late. Unfortunately, her book was called On Sledge and Horseback to Outcross Siberian Lepers, and it's got kind of like a gothic horror ring to it. And some of her detractors got it, you know, it became her reviewers, and they just said never happened. She never went to, she never went there. She never, she never went to Siberia. So I can assure my readers she did, because you know, I saw the same things. I was, you know, I was able to, you know, I photographed the leper colony, and I found this tiny community in a forest that adored her today. And so I'm forging links with them, and I'm sending all my material to them. I'm helping to put material into their museum. And that's a great thing, you know,
that I have this friendship with vindication as well of someone.
Yes.
Many decades after the fact, but it's, wow.
That's... Now, she died in 1931, and she was 71, and she died in a pauper's grave, unmarked grave, which a group of us who like her have found. And we had a grave clearing party on the anniversary of her death about 2 years ago. And a contingency from her, the village where the leper colony is, happened to be coming to London. And one of them was a famous Sakha province actor. And in a dream, he was told to take your shaman's outfit. And he put it in his suitcase. And when he got there, he found that... they found out about my grave clearing party and they joined us, this little contingency from Siberia. And so we had a full shaman ceremony on the gravesite as we were clearing her grave. And they've given a little plaque engraved out in Siberia, which we've had put on there for her now. So now it's marked. But it took 88 years or something like that for it to be marked to this grave. So that was absolutely lovely. And I feel that I'm happy for Kate Marsden, because everybody hated her. Even subsequent biographers were very negative about her. But I say, okay, fine. You weren't perfect by any means. But you made that journey and you did a wonderful thing. And you raised the awareness of leprosy in Siberia, and from then on lepers were looked after, and they were never cast out in the snow to fend for themselves again after that. So, you know, that's great, that's a great thing, you know. And what a shame that she was so forgotten. And she died in a you know, Victorian lunatic asylum, and we know that we're not nice places, don't we? So,
wow, that's a wonderful story.
Yes, so the book is called
Full Circle.
Yes, yeah, the book is called The Extraordinary Tale of Kate Marsden and My Journey Across Siberia in Her Footsteps, and it's coming out next month.
Excellent. I will put a link in the show notes to it, and I'll blast away on social media as well.
Thank you so much.
That sounds like a wonderful story, and it should be made into a movie, perhaps. But
I think it should be. I think all of these actually make really good movies, don't you?
They certainly do.
Certainly, Mary Kingsley and Isabella Godin. Yes, such color. Yes.
The thing I was thinking about when you were talking about Kate Marsden and the vilification and so on is, who is perfect? I mean, I think we still do it today, right? With sporting heroes or whoever it is, we forget they're human beings.
That's right. You think about if she had a charity, and she had nothing to live on, and she took out just her expenses. Mm. If that's what she was criticised for, what do we do now? We have charity shops. Mm. They have to pay their rent.
Yes.
They have overheads.
Yes.
You know, they were criticising her for doing that.
Yes.
The lesbianism, I cannot find any evidence for. And nowadays, we'd say it's no problem.
It's fine.
You know,
yes.
I know that the whole family vowed never to have children because they thought at the time that the consumption was hereditary. And so they said, never have children. So, you know, maybe it's possible, but it was her downfall. It was just and when she was in her 50s, she tried to set up a museum, Bexhill Museum. She was living in Bexhill with two lovely ladies called the Norris sisters, and it was just about to open in 1912. It was about to open, and she had spearheaded the whole thing. Somebody sent a cutting from the Times from 20 years previously. And the mayor said, this woman is having nothing to do with this museum, even though it was her project.
Gosh.
And she was cast out Bexhill.
Gosh. Wow.
And that was 20 years later. You know, it was after this, it was the beginning of the First World War that they, and she kept saying, will you please listen to me? I've read all the letters. You should listen to me. Who said these things? Where is the evidence? Please, can I see the evidence? No one would listen to her.
Wow. Yeah, and 20 years is it's an eternity now in terms of, even 6 months is an eternity.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
You say you speak to her. Is that in the book you speak to her?
Yeah, I go back and visit her.
That's,
yeah, it might sound very strange style talking to you now, but I can assure you that it does make it fly. I mean, you can.
Well, I can imagine, you know, having spoken to a lot of people now, and if I wanted to look at a historical figure and think about why they did something that they did, it might be it's a great way of getting inside their head and their motivations, and you can kind of see how they thought, and
that's
a very useful device.
I think it's worked well as a
device to explore personality. Yeah, absolutely,
yeah, exploring personality. Yeah.
The one individual that we didn't get to was Isabel Brooks.
Okay, this is the most dangerous thing I have ever done. Touch and go, probably we're crossing the length of the Amazon. Yeah, this is. There's no photograph of Isabella Brooks. But her husband was Colonel Brooks, and they got married, and they're both Americans, and he was obsessed with the search for the lost Inca gold in the Yanganates mountains of Ecuador. This is in the Andes, and this is an area very close to the source of the river of the Amazon that I started. Mm-hmm. So it's in the same area. It's all around Banos area in Ecuador. Mm-hmm. Isabella Godin's house was in the Andes as well. But so the Yanganates is a vast moonscape of nothingness. Mm. It's totally uninhabitable area. Mm-hmm. And that is where, supposedly, King Atahualpa's gold is hidden. Mm. And he was kidnapped by the Spanish conquistadors. And they said to his brother, who's... also king of another part of Ecuador, we will let him go if we can have a room for silver and a room full of gold. They got the room full of silver. Mm-hmm. The gold was on its way from Quito. And on the way, they heard that they'd killed King Atahualpa anyway. So what they did was they hid it in the Yanganates Mountains, which I said, this is like the closest thing to Mordor in the Lord of the Rings. It's just totally mm-hmm. wild place. Mm-hmm. So there are certain people that have gone in to try, because there is a map that was drawn by mm-hmm. Valverde, and he apparently knew where the gold was. And if this gold was ever found, I have to point out that it would be billions of pounds worth of mm-hmm. it worked Inca gold, probably masks and figurines mm-hmm. and faces, and it would be extraordinary. And he apparently knew it was, and he drew a map. And it really is X marks the spot. but nobody has ever found it. And lots of people have died looking for it, you know, sort of falling over and having a stake through the heart and all that sort of thing. Now, Colonel Brooks was rather obsessed with this gold, and he took his new wife there, Isabella, into that area as a honeymoon, practically. And they took some guides. Mm-hmm. Now, you're talking about an area where there was, as I say, no paths, there were condors circling us overhead. We knew there were puma, we knew there were wolves, we knew there were bears, called spectral bears. We found evidence of all of those. And there's quaking bogs. And the water can... It's like a massive water collecting area for the Amazon basin. It's all draining off, and it's falling in waterfalls and flowing out into the Pastaza. And you know, we planned this a long time ago. I went with Ken Hames, who was ex SAS, and he'd been there with the SAS, who broadcast. He had a program called Beyond Boundaries,
right?
And he got he wanted to show disabled people that they could do whatever they wanted to do if they tried, and they got them through deserts and and through mountains. And so we organised. We took a crack team with us, but it was so hard to get make any distance at all. Because you have not only do you have the quaking bogs, but you have Fletcher grass, which is like arrows grass, which flicks back to your eye.
Right.
So the story of Isabella Brooks is that they camped by a small lake overnight because the seasons change. I mean, you can see all four seasons in a day there. The season, it began to rain. The water soaked them in where they were sleeping. She caught pneumonia. The guides ran away, and she died within 3 days.
Wow.
And that's... Okay, it was not a very easy journey for me to replicate, but you know, there are lakes named after her, so you can presume the area. But for me, that was so tough. That was so tough. It could hail, it could snow, the sun could come out.
The unpredictability is extraordinary.
Oh yeah, and then the horses, no horses could go in. So we had porters that weren't trained porters, so they couldn't really carry any gear. So we had to shave everything down to the minimum. We were constantly wet, and we had this debate: walking boots or Wellingtons all the time, because you know it's so much mud. I'm quite proud that I did as far as I did, because you know it was so tough, and it was climbing mountains for a while. And but of course, we didn't even found the path, Valverde's path. And there is a most fabulous TV documentary waiting to be made. Because you need to have a huge team to go in there and not necessarily find the gold. Because what would you do if you find the gold? You know, who would it belong to? Would it belong to the state, the government, or would it belong to the indigenous people, you know, the descendants of the Incas? You know, I wouldn't want to be responsible for that. But I think it would be fascinating just to try and find the route of the gold on this map. You know, that would be really good fun. But it was so difficult that after a week we haven't even found ourselves on the trail. It's too difficult. So that's probably the toughest.
Yes. That's all of this sounds amazing. it makes me want to travel, and I'm sure it's going to make my listeners want to travel.
I hope so.
I hope so as well.
Yes.
And maybe it turns some off. I don't know. You know, it really, I think that's one of the beautiful things about traveling, about exploring, about what these women did, is that venturing into the unknown and uncertainty, and you can do some planning, but at some point, you know, the planning
you
is
have to,
material.
Exactly. For me personally, and I think that I'm the same as probably as my ladies that I replicate their journeys. I think that the important thing is having a purpose to your travel.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, I talked about Isabella Bird and having her book and finding all those landmarks that she talked about. Nobody's ever done that. You know, absolutely, you know, finding this mud house that she described sitting out on the balcony and in the winter sun and the painted walls and everything.
Mm.
I think it's just so lovely to have a purpose to travel. And so, as I said, it's never going to be the destination for me. It's always going to be the traveling that's the exciting part. And I think perhaps other people feel the same way. I mean, I actually know of people who are walking across India at the moment and walking around the world, you know, and they all have different purpose, but it's again, it's the traveling and not the destination.
Mm-hmm,
and the information you collect along the way, and then you report back and what you see. And very often as well, we're taking our culture to them. Mm-hmm. They can't come to us. So we're taking our little bit of England or America or Canada or wherever to them. Like Isabella Bird, when they thought it was Queen Victoria coming, you know, she was showing, yes, you know, I'm here and I'm willing to share everything with you and you share back.
I've been to some parts of West Africa, for instance, from time to time. And I don't know if the people I met, I imagine they would have seen other white people before, but not very many. I don't know if you can relate to this at all, or if what I'm describing is completely is different. But you do feel, or I felt, that I'm kind of almost, you're right, representing a culture or a civilization, or
you're taking something to them. Aren't you?
I'm taking something to them.
Yes. As long as you don't go as a voyeur and just stare at them and just take pictures, I think it's really important to integrate. That's what they want, isn't it?
And people are curious. They want to ask questions, and you know, they want to know about your life and
absolutely. And you'd answer those questions and fully integrate them with them as while you're there. Mm. That's the best thing. But just, you know, staring at them taking a picture is not quite the same. But what's been delightful for me with these lady travellers I've been is as I mentioned before, is those ancient ceremonies, because there was the butter tea ceremony in the underground house in Ladakh that I know that Isabella Bird had the same, because we talked about tea with the king, but it's also that butter tea ceremony with that lady, because she said, oh, should I do anything for a cup of tea? I mean, she couldn't stand this butter tea. And then in Mount Cameroon, our guides stopped to sing to the gods of the mountain with palm fronds before we went up. Well, I'm sure that Mary Kingsley had a similar thing happen. Mm-hmm. Isn't it wonderful that 125 years later that can happen? And like drinking chicha out of a calabash on the Amazon River with villagers miles and miles and miles from any habitation, you know. And I find that all very exciting.
Absolutely. It's hard to describe it. You do such a wonderful job of it that it really.
Siberia. There's a lovely ceremony that I've had quite a few times. Is when somebody comes up to you with a loaf of bread and they expect you to take a bit and dip it in the salt that another person is holding, and then you eat that, and then another person comes up with a ceramic bowl with three legs with fermented mare's milk in it to wash it down. That's got to have been experienced by Kate Marsden, hasn't it?
Yes.
All to the years.
Yeah. I imagine that. I don't know. I'm just thinking about the linkage back into the Mongols and the horse culture and all of that stuff. And that type of thing probably existed all around, all through that part of the world. Very interesting. What about, I think there is an element of risk and uncertainty that kind of permeates through your the entirety of your stories.
You but think
I,
so?
And sometimes I ask this very directly of my guests, and sometimes I don't ask it, but very directly. But what about your own attitudes to risk, or have you taken anything from your travels, your work, that you think is applicable to other parts of, I don't know, other parts of life? Or do you have any particular views on how you approach something that's uncertain or potentially risky?
Yes, I find that this sort of spirit of wanderlust does permeate through everything I do.
Yes.
I don't like ordinary life.
Yes.
I find I am an adventure seeker.
Mm-hmm.
And even having an adventure on the way here, I could have had one, you know. Uh-huh. I embrace that sort of thing.
Yes.
And so when I come to write my books,
yes,
because I've kind of encouraged things to happen, it gives me lots more to write about.
Yes.
And often they are risky. But I think it's going up the less ordinary channel, you know, traveling in a different way, talking to different mm-hmm. people, putting myself out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not frightened to do that,
mm-hmm.
to put myself out there. And all of those things just make me feel more alive.
Mm.
I just could never be stuck in a rut.
Mm-hmm.
Just be hopeless. Wouldn't suit me at all.
No. We were talking about this before we started. That,
yes.
You get a lot of people coming up to you saying that you inspire them.
Yes.
And I can see why.
yes.
I think a lot of people in the world are stuck in ruts and you know, increasingly so with things like social media and the internet. And we talked about, well, you're going down the Amazon, you can get emails and things like this, which is interesting and helpful, but
actually I did put a ban on it for a while.
Yeah, right.
Because that just spoiled it for me somehow.
Yes, yes.
I took a small group with me of very nice people, and I wanted them to really I wanted them to loosen their grip on with our world as well.
Mm.
You know, just slowly loosen yourself from your cultural moorings and think what is, you know, and then otherwise if you're always looking at your phone, it's not the same, is it? And oh good, here comes a little oil town that's got a cell phone and we can hook him in. That's not what it's all about for me at all.
Mm.
And plus the oil town for me is, you know, that heralds a whole different whole bunch of problems, because you've probably got oil workers there who have got one spillage a week that's destroying this wonderful place. You know, Ecuador, their forest is 80% virgin rainforest.
Mm.
And if you've got one environmental disaster a week through oil, I mean, you know, that's just awful for the local people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm now very much caught up with helping the people of Sarayaku village, who are Kichwa, who have looked after me, because the Ecuadorian government has sold their land to a oil company without telling them. So now they are fighting for their land. And you know, you're talking about shamans, people who, they got this rich culture that goes back hundreds of years. It was the Kichwa that looked after Isabella Godin in 1769. And now here I am, when I go, I'm fundraising now for them to get a drone so that they can send a camera up, that they can look out across their land and see what's happening. But they have got a wonderful, peaceful way of going about it. And there's a film made that was that's made with Amnesty International. It shows the local people, they kidnap the oil workers peacefully and they kidnap them and talk to them until they realize what the impact would be on their village. And then they make films, and then they use people like me, obviously, you know, my journey. But it, you know, I couldn't just have pitched up on their banks of their village. I mean, I had to be invited, but now I know them quite well. Now it's my second time I went to stay with them. But to me, you know, that's a whole new, different set of problems, isn't it? What they've got, and you know, there's a road now. When I went the first time 6 years ago, we hacked through the forest to get to them, to get to the bit of river where the dugout canoe was waiting, the same point where Isabella Godin's was meant to be waiting and hers wasn't because her advance party had taken smallpox, which makes me think that the Quechua Indians were uncontacted in the 1760s, which is very interesting. So it's the Quechua Indians who looked after us. But now there's a road, which we insisted on walking down. So we did still walked our way through the jungle to get to this. But when you've got a road, you can send in tanks.
Yes.
And the Ecuadorian government will do that. They will send in tanks with the oil companies. So it's a question of holding them at bay.
There's so much wisdom in some of these societies that we don't know about.
Just amazing.
In terms of whether it's, you know, plant medicine or
the biodiversity out there is
taking care of the environment or
extraordinary.
Whatever it is.
It's very sad. So the oil is, and it's not just logging, it's the, it's the oil really.
What do you know? What is it? Any of the international oil companies?
Yeah, well, it's mostly Argentina.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, Brazil and Argentina, and I've heard China, but I have no serious evidence that it's China. But but once the oil rights are sold, what can you do? The Ecuadorian government has got a lot to answer for. Unfortunately, the Ecuador has a lot of debt.
Yes.
And a lot of foreign debt, and that's their way of getting out of it.
Yes. You you might want to listen to what probably I'm not sure what order I will put this episode out, but I spoke to one of the New York Times bestselling authors, John Perkins. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he wrote a book called "Confessions of an Economic Hitman," and he does a lot of work in South America with indigenous communities. But one of his earlier jobs, if you like, and this is what he describes in his book, is selling effectively debt to governments like the Ecuadorian one and Panamanian one, and or getting them into debt, and that leads to investment by multinationals and this sort of thing. There's a trajectory that's a little bit similar to what you're describing there. So it's interesting, and it's interesting what comes out of these types of explorations, because otherwise we don't learn these things. So it's a type of pioneering that exists that we won't be able to discover certain things unless we have people like Kate Marsden and.
That's right.
The other women that you described.
That's right.
Very, very fascinating. I want to be respectful of your time, but before we wrap up, first of all, was there anything that we missed that you'd like to mention? We didn't get a chance to cover at all.
All my notes, you covered them all.
Okay.
The fact that if I was to sum up about these ladies, I would say that they were totally unique. And they were before their time, and I will continue to do journeys in their footsteps. It's obviously I have to get funding. It's quite difficult sometimes to find the funding.
How do you get funding?
I'm mostly self-funded, to tell you the truth. Even when I take a party, I organise it, but I don't take anything from them. I just organise it. I feel that it's hard to get people to fund something that could appear to be a holiday. You know what I mean?
Yes.
But it's not a holiday.
Yes.
Certainly not. But
it's an adventure.
It's an adventure. So, yes, it's been a bit tough. There are journeys I would love to make. Like, I would love to travel the length of the Yukon River in the footsteps of Maud Parrish. And she did it in the Klondike era with 9 pounds of luggage and a banjo. But you see, when she did it in 1900, 1899, there was about 100 boats plying up and down the boat, taking all these gold miners. But there's nothing now. And so I'd have to get ribs up there and find fuel. But that's what I would love to make, that journey. And as long as I've got a beginning and an end point to these journeys, and that's a very good one. possibly what I will do in the near future is go to Lake Chala in Tanzania, mm-hmm. in the footsteps of Florence May Sheldon. Mm-hmm. But she was a bit of a nutcase because she had lots of money, and she had got all these porters, and they even took tables and linen and, you know, best plates. That would be an interesting contrast, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes.
And then, of course, there's Lady Florence Baker, who is very close to my heart, who is Stanley Baker's wife. But between the two of them, they made their way into what is now Uganda, which was then Sudan, and they were sponsored by governments to try and end the slave trade by setting up forts. Mm. And she was so brave. She was just the most incredibly brave lady. And she was actually bought at a slave market by her husband. She was in Bulgaria.
Wow.
And he grabbed her and ran with her. She was sold to somebody else, and he just grabbed and ran with her. And they ended up being a lifelong partnership, living out their life near Totnes in Devon. So there is a Baker Trail now in Uganda. But of course, we're talking about risk, and I have to make sure that it's safe for me to go and just walk that trail. That has in the past been a very difficult area around there. You're getting to be a bit near the Sudanese border. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to put myself at that risk.
Sure.
So I have to have all things covered. Mm-hmm. The trip down the Amazon took me a year to organize because...
Wow.
I was passing down a tributary that the Peruvian embassy had suggested, recommended that I did not go down.
Right. Is this the so-called the red zone? Is that what
it's
called?
Red zone is drugs.
Right.
It wasn't so... But the red zone was much later on for me when we were on the Amazon. This was hostile tribes.
Right.
And there were two hostile tribes. It was the Kandozi and the Achua. And I've talked to you about the Kichwa. Mm. They're very friendly, and although they're very traditional tribe, they are very... But the Kandozi and the Achua, if you landed in the wrong place, they could kill you. And nobody in the Amazon is going to come and find you.
No.
So it took me a year, and I found a guide who does field work for a university professor who knows them all really well, who knew where it would safe for us to go. Mm-hmm. And he came and collected us from Iquitos. He himself was held up for 2 days by an oil blockade because of the environmental crisis on the Maranon. But eventually got away, and he came and got us. And he took us to places I thought were just extraordinary. I mean, he actually took us into Kandozi villages, and without him, that would no way that would be possible. I mean, they were talking about, you know, people they'd killed the week before, and also on our journey, he would point out tributaries. He said, "We won't be going up there. If we go up there, you will never come out again." It's interesting to know that those dangers still exist. You know, I think with globalization, that we live in a sort of sense of false security, that there are places on the earth that, you know, I can travel to from Quito, and I can reach that point where if I put a foot wrong, I can be killed. That's why I had to be very sensible. And that's why I had to keep on reminding the small team I took. I kept to reminding them of the dangers they're in, because I knew much better than them. I had to keep reminding them. And I actually almost cried when we came out of the danger area because I had been so worried about them.
Mm-hmm.
So we must never, ever become complacent about what we do and where we get. And people can turn very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But there are various signs on when you're travelling in places like that. You know, for example, war paint is a sign.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably not going to be very friendly.
Right.
There are other signs in the way that they dress, the way that they move, their body language.
Right.
So, you know, we were with the right people.
Right.
But to have done that journey was my dream.
Yes.
I have to say, I always wanted to do it. Got as far as Belém and flew out. And since then, I've been lucky enough to go back to the Amazon. Since December, I went back in February, and I was able to go to the very, very, very source. And I have a piece of film footage now of the 8-mile width as the water flows out into the...
And that's
great, you know. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. This is fabulous. Where can my listeners find you on the internet and learn more about you and your work?
My book is called Adventuresses, Rediscovering Daring Voyages into the Unknown. And the next book I've mentioned about Kate Marsden will be out shortly. They're available on Amazon, as is the Kindle version. I do have a website, adventuresses.com. And I'm available for people who want me to come and talk. I'm always love coming to talk about this, and I'm very happy to do that if they want to contact me.
Jackie, this was great. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, really Ben. Enjoyed this. Thank you for inviting me. It's been lovely.
Wow, right? Jackie's next book, The Extraordinary Tale of Kate Marsden, comes out on July the 25th. And if you are in the UK, you can attend the launch of her book in Bristol. Details are in the show notes, along with all the other references from our conversation. If you liked this episode, and if you're a fan of all things Risk, give us a review or a rating, particularly on iTunes. It helps us out a lot. Check out the show on allthingsrisk.co.uk. There are all ways in which you can subscribe, as well as some other great stuff. If you have any feedback, you can send that to allthingsrisk@gmail.com. And we have lots more great stuff coming up, so do subscribe and you won't miss it. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, but also keep your eyes out next week as well. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.